Good morning. Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program which is produced each day for those of you who are either open to the realization that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, or have come to the realization that they are counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us anytime over the next 2 hours, is toll-free, 877-300-7645. This next story I have a different view towards than many. It is out of Syria. It pertains to the Islamic State and to Roman antiquities. Militants for the Islamic State set off explosives at a temple in the ancient ruins of Palmyra in Syria. Activists and government officials said on Monday. Actually, they said on Sunday, they're confirming it today. Continuing a pattern of destruction that they have visited upon historical sites across the territory they control in Syria as well as Iraq. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, an activist and monitoring group based in Britain, said Sunday in a statement that the Islamic State fighters had detonated a large quantity of explosives and that they had had arranged these explosives to bring down the temple of Baal Shamin. Baal Shamin. Baal. You know what that is the word meaning?
Well, isn't that the name of the adversary?
Yeah. Yeah. Baal. That means Lord. And what's interesting, of course, is in this land now conquered by and under the auspices of Islam, where Arabic is the language that has been imposed, the temple bears a Hebrew name. Now, Bel is the Babylonian and Persian name of the same god. Of course, the same two consonants. The difference is the vowel, and I think actually the vowel is the same in Bel and Baal, just pronounced differently. But Baal means the Lord, the one who owns, the one who controls. It was the primary deity of most ancient religions, including the Roman religion had a Baal, and the Romans were very accommodating to have a Baal, as were the Assyrians, as were the Babylonians, as were many throughout this region. And the Baal is the first name used of the god of Islam. If you rearrange the Quran chronologically, the name first ascribed to the Islamic god is Baal. Then he becomes Ar-Rahman, and finally migrates to Allah about the time of the satanic verses when Muhammad was booted out of Mecca in shame. The Shamin aspect is also from the Hebrew. It's Shamain. Shamaim is Hebrew for the spiritual realm, the heavens. So this is the Lord of the heavens. Gee, I wonder who wants to be the Lord of the heavens, who wants to be worshipped as the Lord of the heavens, who wants to be seen as owning and controlling the heavens. That would be Hasatan, Satan. And so this is just another in many affirmations that was accurate when he ascribed the name Baal, the Lord, to Satan. And that he uses it throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And so when you're being religious, and whether it be a Muslim, a religious rabbinic Jew, or a Christian, and you use the name Lord, you are referring to this same adversarial spirit. An adversarial spirit that Yahweh, who created him, says is Hasatan, Hebrew for adversary. So here they tore down the temple. Now, that temple wasn't going to last very much longer. Yahweh himself was going to cleanse the earth. Matter of fact, I'm reading right now the the 27th or 28th chapter of Yeshayah, Isaiah. I think it's 28. I've begun translating it because a friend of mine, William in Florida, who listens not only to this program, but mostly listens to the Shabbat program we do on Blog Talk Radio on Fridays, sent me an insight saying that it is apparent that the ultimate human adversary, the man who was controlled by his own admission by this same adversary, demon-possessed, Paul, the author of half the Christian New Testament, is mentioned in this prophecy from Yahweh, where Yahweh calls Shaul death, and where he makes the same statements about Shaul, the name of Paul, as I say, the founder of the Christian religion and author of half the Christian New Testament, that he makes the same comments, the same predictions about him that he makes in Chabaouk. And so I was reading it and translating it. As I began to translate it, I noticed that Yahweh says that he is going to send a deluge from heaven to cleanse the earth. And that he is doing it because of the corruption of primarily of Ephraim, of those not related to Yah. But that means that temples like this will be gone. In fact, all religious facilities, all human monuments to politics and religion will be wiped away. Now, part of me says that leaving these monuments to a horrid human past, coliseums and amphitheaters and temples, has an advantage. And it's the same advantage that the Quran has. The Quran's only advantage is that if you read it, you will come to understand the corrupt nature of Islam. Why Islam promotes 99% of the terrorist acts in the world. Why Muslims kidnap, enslave, and then rape little girls. And so it's important to have the book available so that it can be read and therefore convey important information about how pathetic, how putrid, how destructive, how deadly the religion of Islam is. And I say the same thing about temples like this. You, by maintaining it, you come to know that, you know, there is a serious problem with calling God Lord, because that was the principal name of the most prominent pagan god of all time. So that's advantageous. It's advantageous to know that the popularity of a religion doesn't make it true. There aren't even 1% of people today that would acknowledge the paganism practiced by Rome, Greece, Babylon, Persia, Assyria, Egypt, that the religions that were practiced by virtually everyone in those countries and that were practiced worldwide, very few, maybe a fraction of 1% would view them as true today. And yet these monuments are a testament that it was the primary, almost ubiquitous belief system back 2,000 years ago. So it helps people have a better appreciation for understanding this objection that, for example, Christians and Muslims have to evidence that proves their religions are false. When I systematically demonstrate that there is a 0% possibility that Christianity or Islam can be true, even Rabbinic Judaism, what I'm told is, you know, why would we believe you when, you know, there are millions, hundreds of millions, if not billions of faithful, and there is, you know, what are the odds are that you are right and all of them are wrong? And I say, 100%. I'm right because it's a rational, logical evaluation of the evidence. The evidence does not allow any other rational conclusion. So the conclusions that I'm presenting are absolutely, unequivocally, undeniably correct. The religions are rotten to the core. But why are so many people surprised that the popularity of a religion doesn't make it true. You know, and during the reign of dictatorial regimes 2,000 years ago, they all intertwined religion and politics just as they are today, and their religious schemes were almost universally dictatorial, and they, most of them imposed a caste system. Most of them ran economies based upon both slavery and terrorizing the neighbors into submission. And most of them had a variety of pagan gods, all based upon the sun, the planets, the stars, and the moon, and aspects of the physical world. And yet, they were ubiquitously embraced. Didn't make them true. Just as the popularity of a religion today does not make it true. So, seeing man's horrid religious past, how these temples to false gods were juxtaposed right next to, and in this case, in Palmyra, a political and entertainment edifice, the amphitheater, where the Islamic State has used the amphitheater routinely, and that was as political and religious a setting as was the temple. They've used it to showcase mass beheadings. But these things were intertwined, inseparable, a dominant part of the fabric of the human culture circa 2,000 years ago, exactly as Yahweh said, and why he said, do not emulate the behaviors, the practices of the Goyim. The practices of the Goyim were to worship the Lord of the heavens. This temple stood dozens of meters, footsteps, away from the Roman amphitheater, where the Islamic State held mass executions, killing, in a video just released last month, 25 people, cutting off their heads. The integration of politics and religion, of the gods and the political leaders being connected, is part of the fabric of humanity. It is why these cultures were so reprehensible. It's why they were so deadly. It's why they were so destructive. We'll be back with Shattering Myths, and we will continue the story with Angela Merkel in Germany. Chancellor Angela, and she is no messenger. Angela is the is a transliteration of a Greek word, agelos, is become a popular name because of the Christian influence in countries where Christians are not smart enough to recognize that that Yosha did not ever once speak Greek, that he was not Greek, and that the Greek influence on their religion is pervasive. Paul wrote on behalf of Gnosticism and on behalf of Dionysus. But they use titles like they think that their Jesus is a transliteration of a Greek name. He didn't have a Greek name. This would be Yosha. And then their name of the religion, Christianity, is a extrapolation and transliteration of a Greek word, Christos, which means from Christos to be drugged, not recognizing that he didn't have a Greek title. But nonetheless, she is named Angela after Agelos, the Greek word, and she is no messenger, at least not of Yahweh. She condemned on Monday violent protests against refugees that erupted over the weekend in Germany, blaming them on right-wing extremists who were bent on speaking a disgusting message of hatred. Now, I'm going to tell you that those who were part of the protest are pretty disgusting. And they are right-wing wackos. They're a huge percentage of neo-Nazis. I don't know what percentage, but substantial percentage of neo-Nazis. A lot of Heil Hitler in their rhetoric. And a significant number of the protesters are protesting from the standard right-wing, classic right-wing position of patriotism, of this is my country, you're not going to change it. If you come in, you're going to change it, and I'm not going to allow you to change it, and my country is mine, I'm not going to share it with you. That is the right-wing wacko position that is opposed by many people, including myself. Now, in this particular case, the refugees are Muslims, and they're bringing Islam with them. So they have a point if they can articulate it peacefully, and that's what you need to do, folks. You know, if you want to be opposed to something, and there's nothing wrong with hating Islam. It's the right thing to do. It's not disgusting to hate Islam. It's disgusting to accommodate Islam. It's disgusting to invite this poison that leads to terrorism and pedophilia and rape and enslavery and indoctrination and destruction and death into your home. That's what's disgusting. That's what's hateful, is what Angela Merkel is endorsing. What's responsible is to come to understand the religion and why it has a veritable monopoly on pedophilia, on the slave trade, on terrorism, on decapitations, and why everything that Islam touches is destroyed. Why there isn't anything that Islam can claim that is beneficial. Read the Quran. Read the Hadith. Come to know who Muhammad was. But don't resort to violence. And don't resort to demeaning people because their skin is a different color than your own. Differentiate between ideas. Come to know which ideas are counterproductive. And use words. Now, there is a significant benefit and precluding Muslims from entering Germany en masse. Because in these countries, the people are coming from four countries. Two of them in Europe, two of them in the Middle East. Syria and Iraq. So there are Muslims that in Syria and Iraq that don't want to side with either the Shias in opposition to the Sunnis or the Sunnis in opposition to the Shias, but doesn't change the fact that they're not renouncing Islam. And they come from two other countries outside of the Middle East, Serbia and Albania, where once again, we have Muslims trying to flee. But, you know, if they were to say, we will leave the religion behind that created the hellish conditions we're trying to flee, oh, that'd be fine. But if you want to bring the doctrine with you that has led to the hellish conditions that you're fleeing, that's not acceptable. And Merkel ought to be smarter than that. She ought to recognize that Germany quadrupling the number of Islamic refugees that it is taking in is suicide. It's like saying, you know, I think what I want to do is round up as many rats infested with the bubonic plague as possible, and have at least one live in every German's home. I'd like to return to a story we were covering because I think it's related to the Angela Merkel comments. And Angela Merkel said that these protesters who are protesting the influx of Muslims into Germany won't be accepted, that the German government won't give an inch towards them. In other words, the German government will continue to allow an influx of Muslims. And that those who would say we don't want more Muslims in Germany will not be tolerated. They are not Germans, according to Angela Merkel. Well, then this article, which we were covering last week, is related. It says the Islamic State is making a determined play for Muslim girls throughout Europe, tailoring their calls to their vulnerabilities, frustrations, and dreams, filling a void that Western Europe has so far failed to address. You see, when they came to Britain, when they came to Germany, when they came to Italy and to France, they didn't jettison the religion that was causing the hell that they were enduring, that they were fleeing from. They brought it with them. You know, it's like somebody saying, I don't want to be in Western Africa because there's Ebola there. Well, yeah, I understand that. But you're not welcome in my home if you're infected with Ebola. You know, if you haven't been infected and you want to leave there, I see, yeah, that's a reasonable thing. But don't bring the disease with you. And it is only ignorance and a lack of judgment that causes the preponderance of people today to be unaware that the religion of Islam is the most malignant and caustic disease in the world. It is the most deadly disease, the most destructive disease, the most damning and deceitful disease in the world today. And so once you see Islam as a disease, as something that infects its hosts, kills its hosts, destroys everything that it touches, and is infectious, once you come to see Islam that way, then you're in a position to recognize what the Islamic State realizes, but the leaders of Europe do not. That Muslims don't give up their religion when they migrate out of Islamic hellholes. They bring it with them. And so these girls in throughout Europe are Muslims, and they don't fit in, and they don't want to fit in. And so the Islamic State says, why don't you come to Syria and Iraq where you'll fit in, because we're Muslims too. Now, in socialist secular humanism, you can't ever blame Islam. It's astonishing that socialists, that those who claim to be enlightened, that humanists, would not hold a religion accountable for treating women worse than animals. It is just extraordinary that they wouldn't do that, but they won't. So here's a religion that is responsible for hundreds of millions of genital mutilations, hundreds of thousands of kidnappings and turning little girls into sex slaves, where women have essentially no rights. And yet they won't hold Islam accountable for why these girls are vulnerable to the lure of the Islamic State. They instead want to blame conservatives, social conservatives, who want to keep national spending at a level that is sustainable. And so they say in post-11 austerity Britain. So they want to blame those who would balance a budget, who wouldn't bankrupt the country for these girls being vulnerable and buffeted by a growing hostility towards Islam. And they're incapable, the liberal, the socialist secular humanist, incapable of recognizing why the only rational response is to be hostile to Islam. I mean, if you're not hostile to rape, then there's something wrong with you. And in Islam, rape is legal. If you're not hostile to pedophilia, there's something wrong with you. But in Islam, pedophilia is legal. If you're not opposed to terrorism, then there's something wrong with you. But yet Islam endorses terrorism, encourages terrorism, and perpetrates 99% of the world's terrorist acts. So, of course you should be hostile to Islam. You should be hostile to anything that preys on defenseless people, killing them. Anything this destructive and this deceitful, this immoral, this perverted, ought to be hated. But the socialist secular humanist, steeped in the religion, like most religious people, is incapable of applying evidence and reason to understanding the appropriateness of being hostile to Islam. And so they, again, want to blame what they would view as conservatives for the plight of these girls. That is the conservative that's creating the austerity. It's the conservative that is creating a misguided and growing hostility towards Islam. And then they say, and deep spending cuts, and there are no deep spending cuts. I mean, the fact is that Great Britain, like the rest of Europe, is out of control, as is the United States. Every problem is to be resolved by throwing money at it. And all they're making is the situation worse. They're creating a dependency culture where no one takes any responsibility. And have these, says that these things have affected these women, and that they come to resent Western freedom. Yeah, it's in Islam, they hate freedom. But, of course, this journalist, being indoctrinated in political correctness, has no concept of that. They have no concept of why Islam is opposed to freedom. And all they'd have to do is look up the word Islam in Arabic. It means to submit, to surrender. Islam is the antithesis of freedom. Muhammad spoke of no choices. The Quran says there is no choice for a Muslim. The Quran is explicit. There is no freedom for Muslims. And so they resent Western freedoms. They also see that they, as this article says, they resent the opportunities their parents sought out. Why? Because what Europe has done, what the United States has done, is create a dependency culture. We offer, governments offer, incentives not to be productive, to be dependent. And when you do that, it actually creates a character flaw, a lack of responsibility, a lack of initiative. And if you, you know, there's nothing that is more depressing than being a parasite. You have no purpose in life. There's no reason to get up in the morning. You're not accomplishing anything. You're not contributing anything. You know, it's why Yahweh created the covenant as a relationship where we engage, and where he based it on the family model, where the more you contribute, the more you get out of it. The more you give, the more you get. But if you don't give, you get nothing. If you don't contribute, there is no benefit. Well, that's human nature. That's how Yahweh has designed us. And so those who do not contribute, who become dependents, come to resent the opportunities. Because, well, what if I actually did something productive with my life? You know, then all of these dependency indulgences wouldn't come my way. And then they see Western fashions as sexualizing girls from an early age. And yet they are drawn to a religion that turns tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of little girls into sex slaves. And somehow they see the apparel offered by Western institutions as more perverting and perverted than pedophilia, than kidnapping and enslaving and holding auctions for tens of thousands of little girls. I mean, imagine you've gone that far out of your way to be irrational, but you're going to sacrifice your life to something that's unreasonable. And you can't make that distinction. And this person writing the article is incapable of making that distinction, that contrast, that how somebody could view apparel as something to be disgusted by, but yet embrace the organization that has kidnapped and enslaved and gang raped and sold as sex slaves tens of thousands of little girls. I mean, if you're making a comparison between the two, you've got a Mount Everest versus a sandcastle on the beach. And yet, indoctrinated and politically correct institutions, they're not even capable of seeing it. So who's to blame? Islam, for sure. But rather than trying to blame conservatives for trying to rein in indulgence spending, for trying to correctly view the threat of Islam, they should be pointing the finger at themselves for indoctrinating people to the point that they're no longer able to exercise good judgment. These women, according to this article, see the hijab as a sign of Islamic feminism, as opposed to a symbol of oppression. Hello, Glenn. What do you think about all of this?
Well, yeah, you can have your choice of a hijab, or if you want to go the other way, you could go to the women defending their right to bare their breasts in New York streets.
You know, I'm going to side with the women who want to bare their breasts. I don't have any
problem. Not if you saw these women.
Oh, okay. Well, that's probably true. It might be scarring. But
Yeah. Given
the choice of women having the same rights that men have to walk around without shirts, I don't have a problem with breasts. I do have a problem with religious garments. Fathom that anyone could view religious garb, particularly as it is put on women, whether they be Indian in the sense of Hindu and wearing those wraparound dresses that go all the way up to headscarf, or Amish, Mennonite, and the garb with the special dresses and headgear, or particularly Islam, where they're wearing burqas and headscarves and being treated like the sight of a woman's body is so reprehensible that she should at all costs hide it. She should live under a tent, and that people don't see that as oppressive. I mean, how could you be more oppressive than to tell somebody, your physical appearance is so disruptive, so inappropriate for anyone to see, that you need to go out covering every aspect of your body up. Only your toes and fingers can be seen. Wow. So, Glenn, if the choice is to see breasts or to see a person submit to that kind of oppressive treatment, I'm going to vote for breasts every day. I don't know if we've lost Glenn, but I am repulsed every time I see somebody in religious garb, particularly a Muslim.
Hello.
Yeah, hi, Glenn.
I'm here.
Yeah, yeah, so what are you doing? You're fixated on the ugly breasts of scarring?
Yeah, it's a study in extremes, you know. The hijab does allow the eyes to be seen, too, of course. And let's not forget the funky period clothing of the Orthodox and Hasidic Jews. I find that especially amusing.
Oh, I think that if I look at the Shahs, the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, particularly here are the men and their black hats and their little curly cue coming down their heads and their ugly black suits and just, you know, it's kind of like the Amish men, you know, all dressed in black. And you just go, God, are you going to your funeral? You know, what about life don't you like? What about color and what about light are you opposed to?
Well, it's what's interesting about the Jews is, but the Amish, at least, they're Luddites, they're, you know, separate, cultural separatists. Mm-hmm. But the Jews are culturally integrated, you know, in almost every other way, except for this incongruous period clothing, you know, fixated in the 1800s.
No, but all of this clothing, you know, why did Yahweh see to it that no two people look alike and that no two souls are alike if he wanted us to dress all alike, think all alike, and act all alike? Wouldn't that be counterproductive?
Because he's into diversity, but not hedonism, the way diversity is characterized now. But yeah. it is the whole bare breast thing. But let me tell you, I see it as really ridiculous. I mean, okay, I'm a male, all right? Now, guys, if you're playing basketball and you're doing shirts and skins and some guys took off their shirts and you're in your teens and 20s or something or 30s, okay. But, like, I'm in my 50s. I'm a heavy set guy. I only take my shirt off. I'm going to the pool or the beach. I'm wearing a bathing suit. I don't look grotesque. I'm a moderately fluffy guy, as you once were.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't subject everyone to seeing my bare upper body unless I'm at a pool or at the beach. You know, so this whole thing about New York City is just, you know, I'd be darned if I'd want to be walking through the streets of Manhattan shirtless. It's just pathetically ridiculous.
Yeah, see, I guess we all have different views. I think that personally, and this is just a personal perspective, is that if you are like most people, and the vast preponderance of people, are not physically attractive. And most people are not physically attractive primarily because of obesity and lack of exercise. They eat the wrong things. They eat way too much. You know, it's kind of it's funny here in America. It's the only country in the world where you can be fat and poor. You know, you're on the dole and on food stamps, and yet you're obese. Most people are physically unattractive because they have let themselves go. They've eaten themselves to oblivion and they don't exercise. And seeing a unattractive person without clothes is scarring. As it relates to children, there probably is a real advantage in having even attractive adults dressed so that the children are not confronted with that sort of thing. But as for the rest of us, not a big issue.